It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Saturday to you. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Garrett Joyce and Jordan Heath Rawlings of Sportsnet Magazine. Lots to get to today, including Mike Babcock and his future. Connor McDavid still doing his thing. Garrett's going to go check him out.
Absolutely.
Why not? You can check him out on Sportsnet today as well. Game 6. NFL Draft. Jameis Winston going to the Buccaneers first overall, and it's the fight of the century, millennium, until the next one. Pacquiao Mayweather goes tonight as well. But we start, gents, with the Stanley Cup playoffs. A couple more games yesterday and one game this afternoon, 12:30, Capitals-Rangers game 2, and a game you can watch on Sportsnet. Caps taking game 1 in the dying seconds at MSG. But yesterday, let's start with the opening game of the Canadiens and Lightning series, going a couple of overtimes. Ben Bishop making 43 saves. How many times has Carey Price done that this season to teams on the other end of the ice? The Canadiens feeling what it feels like to be on the receiving end of that. And Gare, the Lightning just continuing their dominance over the Montreal Canadiens this season. They haven't lost to them.
They haven't lost to them, but you know, did they really win last night? Did they outplay them? You didn't really get that sense. It's going to be a competitive series. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it's not going to be a four-game sweep. I thought Montreal looked solid, better than in at least a couple of games. I thought maybe Montreal was hard luck not to eke out a win against Tampa Bay a couple of times that they played them this year. So I can't see this series going less than 6, and I still think it could go either way.
Oh, it's going to be a fun one. Controversy, a little bad blood already. It's great.
Yeah, that goal waved off in the first overtime was a bit of a weird one. I mean, you could see sort of it being pushed in, or the goalie being pushed into the net with the puck as well, but the Lightning do end up winning it in double overtime. Neither team doing much on the power play, both in this game and in the playoffs. Lightning, horrible. And it's not
doing
just
doing nothing
playoffs.
At all. It's nothing. Like, yeah. They're not doing much.
Well,
you're
and that's Stamkos, right? I mean, he's their big weapon there. And when he's not firing, it's going to be tough for them.
How do we explain the Steve Stamkos thing? Hasn't scored in the playoffs yet. There's talk of maybe an injury being to blame. I mean, does that explain it? Has he been unlucky?
I thought I watched all of the Detroit series, and I thought he was skating pretty well. I mean, if he's injured, and you know he might be because it's the playoffs and everybody's banged up, it didn't really look like it. What it looked like is he had bad luck on a couple shots. He hit a post or two, and he had Pavel Datsyuk in his back pocket, and it was just not total shutdown, but just Stamkos needs like just a clear lane to let that shot off, and you know, Pavel's got his stick in there every time it's getting around. So I'm not that worried about it. And if he does get firing, then that is just what a potent offense.
We're talking about Steven Stamkos being the support player for Tyler Johnson at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, if Stamkos isn't producing, but Johnson is giving you Stamkos-like production and you're winning.
An embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
What do we make of Ben Bishop? Because obviously he was good yesterday, but that game's not going overtime without Ben Bishop as well. And he's had moments good and bad overall, Gare, but clearly, I mean, he's a plus. He's in the pro category for the Tampa Bay Lightning because he won them that game yesterday.
Absolutely. Every time I look at Ben Bishop, I think, you know, there's a goaltender that the Blues gave up on, that Ottawa gets for a second round pick that you could have had for a bag of pucks, really. And, you know, I could never figure out why the Leafs didn't take any sort of initiative on trying to go after him. I mean, if you're if your pro scouts are telling you this guy isn't an elite prospect, then it's a failure of pro scouting at that point. You know, now that's a criticism of the Leafs and like all those other teams that don't have an elite goaltender, because he's right there. And last year, Bishop wasn't there. Does Tampa Bay, their playoff prospects last year look different if he's there? I'm sure they would have.
Guys, we almost made it 7 minutes into this radio show before we criticized a Maple Leafs move.
That's a quarter in the jar.
I love the Tampa Bay Lightning. They're my pick to go to the finals. I think as long as Bishop is on his game, and you sort of saw it in the first round where he won them game seven, might have cost him a few goals along the way that somebody else might have had back, but he's a young goalie, and he's so big when he's square to the puck. He's so big in the net, and it just looks like it's impossible to get anything past him. And especially with a team like Montreal, who's, you know, can struggle to score at times, or can at least struggle to get a volume of opportunities.
It looks like he's going to go up in flames every time he gets out of his net to handle the puck, though. Like, yes, he's a looming disaster.
Scary. He is scary doing that.
They need to chain him between the posts. The Calgary Flames, I mean, we've been saying this all season long. I want to say there was four times this season where he said, all right, that's it. Enough with the Flames. They've had their run. They've overachieved to this point, and it's still a successful season, but they're about to go away. One of them was early on when they finally fell out of the playoff picture, found themselves back in, found themselves in the playoffs, found themselves beating the Vancouver Canucks in the opening round series. Now they find themselves down one game to none to the Anaheim Ducks, and it wasn't close in game one. 6-1 in favor of Anaheim. They, of course, were a little more rested. They're at home. They're a better team, Jordan. Is there any reason, though, we should feel like the Flames are still in this thing? Or is this finally, okay, the 10th time this season, the Flames, we've said the Flames are done. They are actually done.
Do I have to be the guy to count the Flames out officially? Because
Look,
we have a story coming up in the next issue of Sportsnet magazine out next week, and go grab it. And it's all about how, you know, this was a team that at the beginning of the year, when we were all talking about Connor McDavid, this was a team who was in the running. I mean, sure, we did a preseason poll of a lot of our experts, and, you know,
picked them for last overall.
They were going to be them and the Sabres. We're going to be going head to head for McDavid. And right now, all we've got is a team that's never been counted out. And I can't count them out now, as much as I totally agree with you, Ben. They looked outclassed the other night.
I just love watching TJ Brody emerge, you know, over these past couple of years, because I'm not even sure that the Flames organization believed in Brody that much, that he's just surpassed anything that they thought he was going to be. And with Giordano out, you know, which is another one of those, I thought that was one of those occasions when they were counted out yet again, when they lose their Norris Trophy candidate defenseman for the season. You know, that's a time when you're like, okay, maybe they're a seller going into the deadline.
How's Chicago doing in these playoffs without Duncan Keith?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, it's insane to contemplate that they could just be, okay, well, keep on going.
Yeah, it is pretty insane. Although game one didn't go so well, they're going to turn to Kerry Ramo for game two after Jonas Hiller gives up the three goals on 14 shots. How legit is that Ducks team, though, Gare? They look like a cup contender to you?
They look like a cup contender. I don't know. I look at their blue line, and I'd like to see a Keith-like presence back there. They don't have that sort of franchise, you know, number one defenseman that you'd like to see with a cup-winning team. And I guess if you looked at it, the last cup winner that didn't have that would be Carolina, that didn't, you know, that was sort of the ensemble rather than the strong lead presence on the blue line. But you can't knock success. They play a heavy game, you know, the cliche saying now, but they're big, They wear you down. They play puck possession. They have Perry and Getzlaf. They're going to be tough to beat. They can't. I think they can be beaten, but they'll be tough to beat.
I'm surprised we didn't see a third period comeback in that first game, because both these teams made their regular seasons on coming back in the third period, and the Ducks did in that opening round series against the Jets as well.
If the Ducks can figure out a way to play with the lead.
Yeah, they got to figure that out. I guess when you have a 6-goal lead, it's a little easier to do. So the game today is game two at MSG, Capitals and New York Rangers, the President's Trophy winning New York Rangers. The Caps taking game one. Joel Ward, another clutch moment in the playoffs. Capitals finally snap their home game seven record and pick up their third ever game seven victory on home ice against the Islanders. So they're kind of playing with house money. Clearly they're the underdogs going into this series on the road against the President's Trophy winning New York Rangers. And Alex Ovechkin seemingly has found himself in this postseason, Jordan.
Oh, I've loved watching Ovechkin this postseason, and really all year. I mean, now that there's a defensive system around him that can sort of free him up a little bit, not that he really ever adhered to his defensive responsibilities before necessarily, but now that there's a structure around him that sort of is built on getting him the puck with room to shoot it, and that goal in game one was just like a thing of beauty. There aren't any, I don't know if there's another player in the world that can score that goal.
And I just love the trash talk after.
Oh, yeah. All series, like, baby.
The ultimate Ovechkin moment.
Hockey needs more of that, a lot more of that. It's so fun.
It's a big talk for a guy who doesn't have a long history of playoff success.
It's image, it's personality. You know, you expect no less.
Yeah, I want him to do the hot stick goal routine next time he scores. And then,
hey, that Capitals team is more than Ovechkin, though. Like, it,
sure,
I picked them to get to the conference final. I'll pick them to upset the Rangers. I think that, you know, Braden Holtby is something that they haven't had in net for a good long time, and there's a more responsible defense around them, and they can play a couple of different games now. Whereas the Capitals of previous years were kind of, well, we're going to run and gun you and try to get you out of the rink, and if we can win 6-5, then that's fantastic. But you know, they can win a 2-1 game now, which is a pretty big departure from the Capitals we're used to.
I thought that people were anointing the Rangers a little prematurely as, I mean, I guess it's hard to argue against them as a favorite in the East to go to the Cup final. But, you know, you look at it, Lundqvist was missing in action a lot of this calendar year. You know, that I keep thinking that something is going to come up there.
Well, they beat up on a crap division.
Yeah.
All year.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, they with Cam Talbot.
Yeah, it's not congratulations, but now let's see what you got.
Yeah, I don't know. I like Washington's chances. I like the Caps' chances before this series started. I think whoever comes out of it, though, loses to the other side, to the Montreal-Tampa winner.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Garrett Joyce, Jordan Heath Rawlings. So the Red Wings are done, losers to the Tampa Bay Lightning in a game seven. So that means
throw the crying towel over to Jordan here.
I know. Let's pause. Can we have a moment of silence, please?
You've had plenty, I'm sure, since game seven. So Mike Babcock now, a head coaching free agent. There was somebody actually with enough stones to ask him about it in that game seven post-game news conference, which is...
Have we heard from that guy since?
That person is, living in obscurity right now. So Mike Babcock, I mean, it was the underlying storyline surrounding the Detroit Red Wings all regular season. Now it's really a thing. Now that they are done, they are eliminated. It's about money to some degree, but Jordan, apparently if you ask the Red Wings and Ken Holland, if it's about money, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, Mike Ilitch has been one of those owners that, as Ken Holland said when they were asking him about Babcock yesterday, that whenever he's needed to step up to the plate, he steps up. There's obviously no salary cap for keeping coaches. And I think it's going to come down to, according to Babcock, it's going to come down to two things, winning and, of course, where his wife wants to go. And, you know,
NHL team in Hawaii, though.
I know, but you could look at that as a reason for him not to come back to Detroit. But on the other hand, there's so much in favor of him returning to the Red Wings. Like, that is a team that is, you know, just built to keep going with success. I don't know if they're necessarily, you would put them in that class of like a team that could, you know, go to the Cup final next year, but they're wild cards and there's a lot of young kids there. And if that's what he's looking for, they're ready to build.
And Detroit has a history of being able to hold on to their management talent. You know, that Holland comes out and tells everyone that the Red Wings won't be outspent. That's just reminding us of their history. You know, when Jim Nill left and took a couple of scouts with him, that was really the first time that anyone had moved out of that organization. I mean, Scotty Bowman goes over to Chicago because his son is moving up in the management table. But I just don't see Babcock going. You know, if there were some sort of friction between him and Holland, if there were, if Babcock was looking at having more control, more say in personnel decisions, if he was looking for a different title, you know, if he wanted to be coach GM, which he doesn't,
yeah, apparently
you know,
not.
You could see a move, but you know, the talk of him going to Edmonton, going to the Leafs, I can't see it happening at all.
Well, and here's the thing is that, you know, we mentioned why he might want to leave, but one of the reasons that he said is going to drive whatever he does is winning. And I think he's always been a guy that's gone from a winning situation to a winning situation. And I said, I wrote a little article this week about he's never rebuilt anything, right? That's not what he does. He comes into situations that are stocked with talent and he implements a system and gets everybody on the same page and is a master motivator. So I think we all probably agree that of the coaching jobs, he could have his pick of them, whichever one he wanted. And where do you guys think is the best place for him to go if he wants to be set up for winning for the next 5-10 years?
Well, if money is not an issue, he's going to get his money wherever he goes. If winning a cup is, I mean, it's an issue, but it's not like he's never won a cup. He's already accomplished that. Is there not something to doing something you haven't done before, like rebuilding a franchise, like starting from scratch, like starting from a pretty good base in Edmonton or from complete scratch here in Toronto? We've heard it before. I mean, Brian Burke talked about it. I mean, there's no better place to win than in Toronto. We wouldn't know because it hasn't happened in so long. But maybe there is an allure of that final pot at the end of the rainbow being the first guy to do it, Gare. Is that something that could play into this discussion?
I think the allure of Toronto is imagined by people in Toronto. I don't know.
Well, I
don't know that it really plays out there with
if you're
with
from
hockey.
Here. If you're from here, right? Like you could, if you grew up with the idolizing the Maple Leafs and Maple Leaf Gardens and wishing for a Stanley Cup every year, year after year, and you have a chance to affect the fortunes of this franchise. Maybe it's something, but if you don't, if it's not part of your personal history, I guess. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not a grander hockey thing.
Hey, it's a risk reward that I wouldn't want to get into. The risk that's attached to trying and failing doesn't justify the potential reward as far as I'm concerned.
And if this is something that we're talking about, oh, you know, people from Toronto want to come back and be a hero in the city where they grew up wearing a Leaf sweater, and it's fantastic. When's the last time that actually happened? We're talking about, oh, Steven Stamkos is going to come back and be a Maple Leaf for sure. It doesn't happen. It's a business, and
David
Toronto
Clarkson.
Is a wasteland. David Clarkson.
You talk about the allure of Toronto, and I mean, you could just take a picture of Brian Burke right now, and it's like that old ad, you know, this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs.
Come back to Toronto, make a bunch of money, get hounded by the media, get called a loser by people in the grocery store, and get run out of town on a rail. Sign me up.
But the bar is low, at least, right? Like
the bar's on the floor.
Right. Like expectations couldn't be lower. Like if you make the playoffs in 3-4 years, you know, win a couple of games, make a second round in 5 years.
But that's not what motivates a guy like Babcock.
No, because you think you can do more than that. But you know that if you're a slight failure, you're going to be in a pretty big success here.
You know, that's like saying, you know what? We're going to use rope rather than nails when we hoist you on the cross, right? Like, it's not super promising to, you know, to get Mike Babcock to walk away from Detroit where he has all kinds of support, you know, a potential to win, a pipeline, an organization. The idea that, oh, yeah, you know, you can come to Toronto. Maybe you can just be a whipping boy. You go from, you know, Hall of Fame coach to whipping boy.
To the guy that couldn't fix it.
Or yes. You could go to the guy who's the greatest. You would supplant Scotty Bowman as the greatest head coach in the history of the National Hockey League. If you won here, don't you think? Like, if you were the guy, first of all, with the history he already has, and then you come here and you succeed, I mean, that's legacy stuff, right? Or am I making too big a deal of it?
Well, I think it's good to note that I started this by asking a question about where would Mike Babcock go if his goal was to win, which is what he stated. And the right. next thing that got brought up was Toronto, and that is insane.
Yeah, not happening.
Okay, so, I mean, that makes sense. If your goal is winning, clearly, if you want to just rebuild and put your stamp on things, maybe it's a different story. But the Edmonton Oilers have now kind of entered this discussion now that they will have Connor McDavid to go alongside those other young players. Does that make sense? You're not going to win next year in Edmonton, but you have a generational talent in Connor McDavid. Does that at all intrigue Mike Babcock?
It might. I don't really see it, but I think that the hiring of Chiarelli in Edmonton might make the job a little more attractive. I think it'll make the job more attractive to coaches other than Mike Babcock. Because the Edmonton had a terrible reputation around the league as far as their management structure went. You know, it was pretty telling that Craig McTavish's name didn't even come up in the press conference announcing Chiarelli right. as the new GM. You know, maybe I get the sense. I mean, the one thing is Edmonton does have those glorious pieces to work from. I don't think all of them will be there at the start of training camp. I can't see what they're going to do with Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and McDavid. I think you have to take one out of the picture.
You need some defensemen.
You do. And Nugent-Hopkins has enough cachet. I think you could get something pretty significant back for him.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation there. And especially when you talk about a potential coach like Babcock, who at the very least has prairie ties. He's from Saskatchewan. So you know there wouldn't be – he's from Saskatchewan. You know there wouldn't be the why in the world would they want to go to Edmonton and take those terrible winners and that kind of stuff. So that's there. Also, I mean, you look at the forwards on that team and – Babcock presumably is going to continue to coach Team Canada as long as he wants to coach Team Canada, and that's the next generation of Team Canada forwards there, at least a number of them. So
the one thing you know in Edmonton is that they won't have an AHL coach as their head guy next season.
Right.
You know, that's not happening. We're not going to have Ralph Kruger, right? Those days are done. You're not going to trust the family jewels.
And if Hitchcock is really over in St. Louis, that's an interesting fit, I think.
Oh, then you know what? I can't see that one at all. Hitch
no?
is bad with young players. He's the complete
but
hard
that franchise
ass.
Needs
the
some,
bad
yeah.
cop. You know, like he's the guy you bring in after this guy, maybe. But
guess so.
I don't
I just
see
feel
Hitch
like that's a
him.
Franchise that really needs some stability, some structure, and they haven't had it from the very very top on
but
down.
But do they
for...
need tyranny? Right. That's the question.
There's a reason why Ken Hitchcock only lasts a couple of years at each stop, right? Like wears out his welcome a little bit, but he can take a good team, make them great for a little bit, no question about it. So we mentioned Connor McDavid, Game 6, Erie Otters and Sioux Greyhounds tonight. You can watch it at 7:30 across all the Sportsnet networks and Sportsnet 360. You're going to go check that out, Gare.
Absolutely.
Connor McDavid, all he has is 37 points in 14 playoff games, 18 goals. We've all seen him on TV. You've seen a lot of these top prospects. I mean, where does he rank as far as is there a comparable? Is like, can you hype him enough for what you've seen?
Well, this is what I can say. I spent a good 6 weeks of the spring of 2005 going game to game with Sidney Crosby, back when I was writing a biography of him as the artist as a young player. And to me, there's no comparison between them. And that's saying a lot, because Crosby, scouts that I talked to then were saying this is the best guy that we've seen since we've been in the business, sort of post-Gretzky, post-Lemieux. And those same guys now are piling on with McDavid. That really, there isn't much of a comparison between Crosby and McDavid at this point. I got trashed for reporting something along those lines a year and a bit back, but it's true. Like this, the difference between Crosby's skating and McDavid's skating is quantum. McDavid will come into the league as one of the, he'll be no worse than the second or third best skater in the league. When I ask scouts for comps as far as McDavid's skating, they came up with some names that were of interest, but Pavel Bure was the one name that was presented by a couple of guys. And the thing is, this kid has more magic and vision than Bure did, and Bure's career was sort of short-circuited by injury. I think we forget how good he was as a young player before he had a bad knee. But McDavid is the real deal. God, I'm praying that they get by the Sioux tonight, because it would be great to see him in a conference final, and maybe in a league final and in a Memorial Cup.
So next year, then, he's in Edmonton, maybe not alongside Nugent Hopkins, but with Hall and Yakupov
with
and Everly.
Hall.
Yeah, with Hall. Where would it not shock you to see him finish in league scoring?
Oh.
I'm just putting you on the spot now for
first fun.
I'm just doing it right now.
First by 20 points.
Well, I don't know who's going to beat him for Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, like, forget I think about that. I want the actual safe top scorers list.
I guess he could be, he's going to be the league student athlete of the year.
That's right.
The academic performer. No, I would think that he can be 40-60, 40-70. You know, I mean, it depends. I can tell you one thing. Taylor Hall will have his best year. Absolutely no doubt about that.
Don't they need to surround him with a few more veterans on that team? I mean, is this offseason going to be about Edmonton trying to find somebody that can, you know, well, I don't know if protection's the right word, but maybe there's some of that as well, on ice protection, about nobody's touching Connor McDavid, but as far as...
He's hard to catch up to.
Right, so that's that's helpful.
How about a goalie?
Well, I mean, there's that.
That might help.
There's a lot of question marks still in Edmonton.
You asked me what he would score. You didn't ask me if he'd win.
Yeah. Well, that's another issue altogether, and probably still a few years away are the Edmonton Oilers. When we come back, the NBA playoffs in full swing. Game 7 between the Spurs and Clippers going tonight. Also, the NFL draft kicked off on Thursday. Jameis Winston, to nobody's surprise, really, going to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at 1. Marcus Mariota. The Titans did not trade away that pick. They took him at 2. We'll talk about both of those things coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Jordan Heath Rawlings on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Jordan Heath Rawlings. The NBA playoffs continuing round one, wrapping up tonight at Staples Center. Clippers, Spurs, Game 7, Eastern Conference all set. The Cleveland Cavaliers will play the Chicago Bulls in the second round, and the Cavs will not have Kevin Love for the remainder of the NBA playoffs after his dislocated shoulder resulting in surgery, out 4 to 6 months. J.R. Smith also suspended for the first two games of this series for his, forearm shiver, I guess, to the face of Jay Crowder. Guys, the Cleveland Cavaliers are clearly championship or bust, obviously, when you return LeBron James to Cleveland, best player on planet Earth. You surround him with Kevin Love, but now Love is gone. Kyrie Irving, still one of the best point guards in all of the NBA. I mean, how legit are these troubles and concerns, Gare, when you're talking about a Chicago team that can look pretty dominant at times? And if the Cavs don't have Kevin Love, how does that change things for them and their outlook going forward into the second round series?
I look at the Kevin Love loss and think, you're not winning a championship. Yeah. Whether you win this round or not, you're not winning this championship. And Chicago is such a flaky team, right? They can beat and lose to anybody.
Yep.
How the loss of Love affects the Cavs' fortunes in this round, you know, Tristan Thompson, a nation turns its lonely eyes to you, you yeah. know, maybe it's good as a stopgap, but that's just as a stopgap. You know, I think the long-term prospects of the Cavs this spring aren't great. And then you're asking, if Kevin Love walks, exactly what have you done trading the first overall pick? The first overall pick last spring and the first overall pick the year before for Kevin Love. I mean, it could go down as like one of the worst trades ever.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's mentioning Anthony Bennett in that trade, but yeah, you're right. A couple of number one overall picks and Andrew Wiggins named NBA's Rookie of the Year. Imagine that team with Andrew Wiggins. Now, maybe it's a different scenario and maybe he doesn't develop the way he has in Minnesota if he's playing a limited role on this Cleveland team. He was allowed to grow and do whatever he wanted, really, on that Minnesota team. And
he would have figured it out.
I think so. Yeah. And by this time, he would have maybe been a little seasoned. And wouldn't that have been a nice little card in your back pocket to play here in the second round?
And not only that, I mean, for a lot of this year, Kevin Love was certainly not fitting in with, or at least not fitting into the degree that everybody assumed he would, meshing with James. So you can make the case that even without this injury, Wiggins
Kevin
might
Love
have been
was
better.
Sending smoke signals out, like, I fit in? Do they fit in around me? Like, it was a soap opera. It's a potential mess.
Meanwhile, Andrew Wiggins was going out there every night on a losing team and busting his butt and playing great defense, which is the one thing I think that has really opened a lot of people's eyes to what the Cavaliers might have been missing out on, right? We kind of knew that Wiggins would come into the NBA and especially on a team that had no other options, put up his points once he figured it out. But the fact that he was playing lockdown defense on some of the best stars, well, I mean, he went head-to-head with LeBron himself and didn't acquit himself all that badly. And you got to think LeBron's dribbling down the court facing this kid and thinking, whoops.
Yeah, I mean, it's a function more of ego than chemistry, you know, that trade.
So is the NBA.
So is the NBA. But you know, if it was all about winning, which that was the presentation of it, and the idea that you have a better chance of winning with Love rather than Manning, I don't see it.
Or Wiggins, yeah.
Or Wiggins, sorry.
Yeah, it's I guess it was more of a sure thing, right? Like you knew what Kevin Love was and you didn't really know what you had in Andrew Wiggins, but certainly hindsight being 2020, you'd like to do a do-over on that, especially if Kevin Love departs this offseason and you don't win a title. It could be a nightmare scenario.
Even if you do win a title, which they probably won't, but even if they won with Kevin Love out,
they're not winning without Love.
If you win a title, I mean, it's all moot. I mean, it's flags fly forever. If you win a title, it doesn't matter what the next 5 years, 10 years look like. You won a title in Cleveland, a place where they can't win a title in any
Cleveland.
Sport. Yeah, speaking of Cleveland, NFL draft taking place starting on Thursday. Buccaneers To no one's surprise, take Jameis Winston first overall out of Florida State. Marcus Mariota going to the Titans. We all expected him to go to. Maybe the Titans would trade that pick, though. They held on to it. Jordan, Jameis, we know the off-field, whatever. I mean, some of it's pretty serious. The crab-like stuff, I don't know why we're really getting in a tizzy about that. And then after being drafted, posting a picture of yourself with some crab legs. Okay, that's kind of comical. But the other stuff is pretty heinous. But as far as his actual ability to play the position of quarterback, he's going to be thrown right into the mix day one, you would imagine.
Yeah.
Exhibition season, he's going to be the starter, going to be taking first-team reps. Are we sure that he is the best NFL-ready quarterback out of the two?
I mean, as with all things in the NFL, it depends on where you land.
Yeah.
But he certainly has the most NFL-ready skill set of all the quarterbacks in the draft. And to a certain extent, the stuff about the crab legs, leaving aside the other nastiness, the stuff about the crab legs is just, you know, a young, cocky kid being a cocky kid. But my feeling about Winston in Tampa Bay is that he's got all the receivers that he could ask for. There's a great tight end. There's Mike Evans, Vincent Jackson. But he's going to be walking in to a situation where there is no offensive line to speak of. And for a guy that at least in college was known to sort of hold on to the ball and try to make things happen and try to force the issue, he is going to get murdered if he tries to do that in the NFL behind that line. And I would say that probably Marcus Mariota might have a more successful first season. I don't think you can project beyond that, really, but just the way they're respectively set up.
Pretty incredible after the year that the NFL has off the field last year.
Yeah, this is the last thing they needed.
That Jameis Winston would go first overall. He was not in attendance yesterday in Chicago. He was back home, but there was some conspiracy theory running amok that a bunch of these players didn't attend the draft because they had Beats by Dre contracts, that they couldn't wear their Beats by Dre at the draft because the NFL had a contract with another headphone supplier. So I don't know if that plays into it, but that would have been something to see Roger Goodell hugging Jameis Winston as the first overall pick of the NFL draft. As it stands, he didn't have to do that. That's not an image that will live forever in history. Marcus Mariota, though, goes to the Titans. There was talk about Chip Kelly and the Eagles trying to sell the farm to move up to two to get
it's
his
It's crazy what they
Oregon
were prepared
duck.
To pay.
Well, do you believe that? Do you believe that, I mean, what we saw is correct with the big ransom that they would have offered?
Two firsts, a third, and
Bradford.
A van full of players.
You don't think that's smoke and mirrors? Everything the 48 hours before the draft starts is gamesmanship. And they were, if you put that out there, maybe San Diego comes in tries to bully you out of the water. I think they were always prepared to take Mariota.
I don't doubt that Philly was in the mix and chasing. Like
I'm sure they.
Yeah. And if it's two firsts, I think it's a huge gaffe by the Titans.
Yeah, if it
to
was
not t- take it.
If it was two firsts and Bradford, would you have not taken that if you're the Tennessee Titans?
Well, I'm going to be one of those guys that would just write Sam Bradford off as not even a part of that package. I would be surprised if he did anything more next year than went head to head with Mark Sanchez for the starting job. And so that's not a win for anybody. Mariota fits well with the offense for the Titans. And they went out and drafted Green Beckham in the second round. So now you've got DGB and Justin Hunter and Kendall Wright in the slot. And theoretically, you're hoping that Bishop Sankey can show. So that could all of a sudden be a pretty good offense there. And a pretty good offense might be all you need because the Colts don't have a very good defense.
As much as we think Jameis Winston has an NFL-ready skill set, there are question marks about Marcus Mariota. And can he go under center and run a pro-style offense? I don't know. I guess his pro day showed a little bit of that, but I guess we got to see it to believe it. When we come back, it's the fight of the century for now until the next one. Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather. It's not cheap, and apparently, if you're like an A-lister, you might not get into this thing. The list of some of the people left on the outside looking in is pretty hilarious. We will talk about the state of boxing and looking ahead to tonight's big fight, Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather, and we'll find out if any of these gents want to put down the $99.99 to go watch this thing on pay-per-view. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Jordan Heath Rawlings. It's, I don't know, the biggest fight in my lifetime, I think. And Holyfield, Tyson up there. But Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather going to do it up tonight at the MGM. It is a tough ticket, to say the least. Maybe the toughest of all time. Ringside seats going for about $100,000 on ticket broker websites. Michael Buffer, who will actually be announcing this thing, can't get a ticket. He'll be there as a credentialed member of the media. The Maloof brothers, only one of them was able to get in. The mayor of Las Vegas, Carolyn Goodman, can't get a ticket. It's a big deal. It's going to cost you $100 if you want to watch it on pay-per-view. And as hyped as this fight is, for the amount of money it's going to generate for both guys, 60% for Manny Pacquiao, 40% for Floyd Mayweather, other way around, 60% for Floyd and 40% for Manny, it, for some reason, and I guess I get it, it opens up the conversation about whether boxing's dead because we can't see the next fight on the horizon, right, Gare? Where do you land on that? Because I feel like we've had that conversation a couple of times over the last couple of decades, but there's big fights keep presenting themselves.
Well, let me just back it up one little bit here. The toughest ticket ever was in fact when James Scott was fighting out of Rahway Penitentiary, right? Because like you didn't get your way in with money, right?
Yeah, you're right. Okay,
you paid a big price.
You're right. that's right.
It is a really tough time in boxing. There aren't fights that cross over to the general public out there on the horizon. There are some great fighters. If you're a fan, there's all kinds of interest, you know, within the culture. But for, you know, as far as $99 pay-per-views and things like that, ones that celebrities are going to gather for, no, you know. And it's funny, I like sitting back and looking at this, you know, I just did a quick look through the rankings of the top 10 pound for pound fighters in Ring Magazine's rankings. Only two are American.
Yeah.
Right. In the light heavyweight division, there's only one American in the top 10. There's two Canadians, right? And you go through the ranks and you see this play out, that there really isn't a strong American presence. But there's an amazing international presence. And it's only going to be bigger, you know, with the doors opening up and Cuban talent coming out. And boxing's sort of in a place where soccer was back in the 70s and 80s, right? You know, it's a cult sport in North America, you know, with a devoted audience, but small, very much a niche. Internationally, boxing isn't talking like this. Boxing fans aren't having this conversation.
Yeah,
there are fights out there for. Yeah,
in Ukraine they're going bananas over the Klitschko's.
In the UK, boxing's in really good health at this point, and there are fights out there, whether it's Amir Khan or
Is it growing anywhere, though? Or is it just, it's still popular in those other places and the decline
is in America? Hugely popular in those places.
But is it growing? Or is it just as popular as it's always been? Well, its popularity here goes down.
It's growing in the absence of you know, the North American talent pool. You know, we had this talk before we went on air. You know, the heavyweight division now is not quite American free, but it's free of elite American talent. The best fighters are internationals, guys who've had like extensive amateur careers. The dynamic there is turned around. I think boxing boxing's been counted out so many times.
Right.
You know, and variations on this conversation played out in the 60s. Sonny Liston, you know, a convict, you know, a gangland figure. His presence as heavyweight champion and supposedly invulnerability there was supposed to be a death knell for the sport. It didn't really play out that way. Ali comes in and then boxing takes off like it never had before.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, we've had this conversation. We've said boxing's dead. There's no future in boxing. It's a slow decline. Here we are, though, with the biggest cross sport, you know, as far as world attention to one boxing match, probably the biggest in the last 10 years at least, 20, 30, 40. I don't know. How far back do you want to go? And I know it's hard. You can't see another one on the horizon. I guess maybe we could have seen this one. We probably should have seen it 5 years ago. But I don't know. They seem to come when you don't expect them. And maybe there will be one that we can't see right now as far as the next big one.
Talent has to emerge. But talent will emerge. It'll be interesting. There are good fighters out there. But you know, generally you're going to see someone pop up in an Olympic Games like De La Hoya did and yeah, various others before, you know, and that sort of is the seed that's planted that play, you know, with a crossover audience for hardcore boxing fans. They're going to be up to date and know who's out there.
I mean, hardcore boxing fans are not going anywhere. I mean, I don't think that's the conversation that we're really having, right? I mean, hardcore fans of any sport are going to stick there. Hardcore cricket fans are not going anywhere either. And there's that kind of thing. I mean, it's more about whether it still has that crossover potential. And I mean, we're seeing it from this fight, obviously. And I think as a layperson who would bow to Gare's wisdom on all things fight related, the thing for me is that it takes to get a casual fan excited is a white hat. Boxing has no shortage of black hats over the years, right? And you're talking about Liston, and then Ali comes in, and you have
Ali was a bit of a black hat in his day, though.
That's true. But you have Mayweather now, who I think nobody is debating is the black hat, and you know he's eminently hateable for many reasons. And sure, Pacquiao is a guy who, you know, might be a little bit past his prime,
Tyson,
for sure,
was
but is
a black
guy,
hat,
yeah,
right? Like, oh, there, yeah, you can, yeah, have black hats.
You can, but you also then need somebody to root for to topple them.
Well, yeah, you can just line up the potential victims. Like, that's what, well, that's what it was for.
I don't think anyone was root. I don't know if that's true, but I Tyson was obviously not a likable person,
no,
but he was must watch. You had to watch
him. Oh, right? Yeah. I'm not denying that the black hats make it watchable, right? The same way that an evil the Yankees would help make baseball watchable. If you were not a Yankees fan back in the late 90s, you were hate watch, and you were hoping that any of these underdogs could take them out. And that's kind of, I think, what you're going to see tonight.
It's funny because it's force of personality more than anything that sells these fights.
Yes.
Because for hardcore boxing fans, as much as they're looking forward to this,
I mean,
people just look at Mayweather and say he's the most negative fighter of his stature.
De La Hoya Mayweather was kind of a snooze for me. For a guy who doesn't watch a lot of fights, I mean, that was, he was technically brilliant, apparently, but that was, and I don't know, is this going to be any different than that?
You know, he's a spoiler. That's what he is in the ring.
Well, technically brilliant, too, is often a death knell for casual fan. Like, I mean, the New Jersey Devils played tactically brilliant hockey, and
exactly,
it was a snooze fest.
But it's must-watch television still. I mean, if you want to plunk down the $100, but I mean, just for the celebrity sightings, the whole event, right?
It's a spectacle.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're plunking down $100 and watching this tonight and saying, what would this have been 5 years ago?
Yeah.
Like when they're close to prime, rather than 38 for Mayweather and 36 and with hard miles on Pacquiao. You know, I would have been a completely different fight completely. I look at it when Pacquiao was taken out by Marquez. I thought, you know what, this is it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, that was a chilling knockout, you know, and that he's rebounded in the wake of that and had some pretty impressive outings. Hey, you know, if this fight wouldn't get made coming off the Marquez loss, not at all. There's like zero interest.
Okay, so whenever you talk about boxing in the United States and North America, you talk about, oh, the heavyweight division is dead. I mean, should that matter? Should we even be talking about the heavyweights? Because, I mean, these guys aren't heavyweights. It's the biggest fight of all time. Do we really need a heavyweight division to be dominant in boxing? I mean, outside of the Klitschko brothers fighting each other, which will never happen. I mean, that could be the next super fight.
Yeah.
That would be the next super fight. But do we need the heavyweights really, Gare?
Absolutely.
You do?
Yes. You know, because the thing is, the heavyweight champion of the world is the baddest ass on the planet. And this is a fight tonight for the baddest ass 147-pound man on the planet. Like, there is a dynamic difference there, right?
But the heavyweight champ of the world anymore, with the way these big, huge, skilled, muscled athletes have gone, is not going to be the baddest ass on the planet anymore.
Oh. Well, I mean, Vladimir Klitschko's breaking Floyd Mayweather over his knee.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm not arguing that they could, you know, decimate little 140-pound Floyd or whatever. I'm just saying that other sports superseding boxing has taken the draw of being that huge, dominant athlete. Like, where would they go? Why would they go into boxing now? They're in the NFL. They're in the NBA.
Why does anyone get into boxing? I mean, is there anyone that grows up affluent in a good area that ends up as a professional boxer?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Show me the example.
But I will say, boxing is badass. Like, there's absolutely no doubt about it.
Crazy
Ray Lewis could get in the ring with the middleweight champion of the world, and he wouldn't be there in 3 minutes. Like, there's absolutely no doubt about it. It's a badass thing. And, you know, that is the mystique behind it. Like, Sonny Liston or George Foreman or, you know, these heavy, heavy hitters in the heavyweight division, like when they would take someone out, like, I mean, it's like a bullfight. Like, you're not thinking about an outcome. You're thinking about like the worst possible outcome, you know, that someone's going to not just be carted out on a stretcher, but you know.
Oh, well, that's a draw.
But you know what? Like, it's
bloodlust.
It is. Like, it's the danger factor. You don't want it to happen, but it's the prospect that this is out there. You know, it's not like going to NASCAR and waiting to see someone crash.
No, because the purpose of it is to create a crash.
No, that's not fair. But it's the danger associated with the act, and there's nothing more dangerous than getting in the ring with the heavyweight champion of the world, you know, and someone who's in line for that, because, you know, there is a terrible cost that you're risking. So it would be great if there was a heavyweight champ.
We know, at least one of the hangups I have about boxing is that the outcome is sometimes curious and head scratching. We know, at least I think I know, everybody wants a rematch here, right? Like, what's the scenario that results in a rematch? Manny wins, there's a rematch. Manny wins, there's a rematch. If it's a draw, there's a rematch. How curious are you to see that final decision, Gare? I mean, there's going to be a lot of eyeballs on this, but it hasn't stopped the judges in previous fights from issuing a controversial decision.
Boxing has its own logic on these things, and you cannot predict it, because if there was ever going to be a rematch in a super fight like this, Hagler and Leonard would have fought a second fight.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you have a decision that people dispute that, you know, you have Hagler's cornermen telling him, like, you're home and cooled out. Like, I mean, that was one where they could have sold on a scale beyond what we're looking at for this fight now. And I mean, the Hagler-Leonard was an that was just, it was a good fight, not a great fight. It was but for drama, it was dynamite. And the personalities, the crossover appeal, and there was no rematch. So I don't know that we can say any outcome here gets a rematch. You know what? I think a draw would be deadly for this, right? I think a win for one that's a disputed decision or something along those lines.
You think? But I've thought that before, and we've seen weirdo decisions. Really, like, you have enough faith in boxing judges to not screw this one up, to not have ulterior motives. I don't know. I've seen enough boxing.
No, of course, there's always that prospect and you know, the thing is, what I would say is, looking at this fight, the guy most likely to be the beneficiary of a bad decision is Mayweather.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah. And absolutely no doubt in that, you know, he takes air out of fights, and he, you know, he scores and just spoils. Like, it's a fight. His style of fight, it lends itself more to what judges look for than what the public looks for.
Right.
You know, and I think that if there's a bad decision, it's going to go Mayweather's way rather than, you know, some sort of idea of rooting for the underdog or the hero or whatever you would characterize Manny as.
Wow, you guys are really making me pumped for this fight with the tactical brilliance, but a boring fight and a potential for a
screw job.
Judging
issue. I'm not trying to sell it. I'm just trying to be realistic.
I'm glad that you're not trying to sell it, because I ain't buying it.
It doesn't need to be sold.
It does to me.
Well, speaking of being sold, yeah, we mentioned the pay-per-view is going to go for $99. Is that part of the boxing decline we're talking about as well, that it is pay-per-view? It's not regular cable. It's kind of different in that regard. Now, UFC, they have their pay-per-views as well, but they do a whole lot of free stuff.
And they're not $99 either.
And they're not $99 either. I mean, how much of the pay-per-view thing plays into the boxing decline?
Well, it plays into it for a casual fan like me. Now, granted, I understand the economics of boxing mean that you can't just take this fight of the century and put it on free-to-all cable TV and hope that, you know, enough people do it to keep it alive. But for somebody who's got a meager interest at best in boxing on a day-to-day, month-to-month, or even year-to-year calendar, to have something like this that I might actually get excited about, that, you know, Gare's talking about and people in the Sportsnet newsroom are talking about, and what are you doing on Saturday night? Are you watching the fight? Well, no, because I don't have $100 to plunk down, and I can find better things to do with my time than hope a couple old fighters can be worth $100 and not the judges don't screw it up.
Does it speak to the overall decline of combat sports? I mean, we saw that first event in Toronto do huge number down at Rogers Centre, but subsequent events both here in Toronto and in this country, in Montreal, they failed to garner that kind of attention. I mean, is it just the culture shifting a little bit, Gare, or will there always be that bloodlust and the want to see, you know, human nature on display, the most primal of primal sports?
Well, I think that boxing and mixed martial arts, UFC, however you're going to type it, I think they need a presence on network television as sort of an approach to developing that crossover interest. Back when, and NBC Sports is recently jumped in and thrown on like they've launched a series of fights, and I mean there had been nothing as far as boxing. You know, I mean, it was an Olympic sport. You wouldn't see a boxing match on TV on free network TV in the interim. So I do think that that's important for developing interest. The one thing is Dana White in UFC is savvy enough that, like, I think he would be able to figure this out. But he also has enough clout that he can organize the sport. Boxing is so freaking unorganized.
It's a mess. I mean, yeah, there's just so many belts.
Yeah. It's
a casual fan doesn't know where to start.
No. And I mean, there is no schedule. Dana White can create the schedule. They're in boxing. You make fights, right? Yeah. They are not scheduled. Mandatory. It's sort of mandatory according to the association until someone slides some money to the right executive. And then all of a sudden the rules change, right? If boxing could get its act together, which is a big if, and get back onto network TV in a regular basis, then I think you can grow the sport back up.
Well, is there a chance that instead of being the end of the popularity of boxing tonight, it being the start of something? Like, is there a chance that it's like the start of some momentum for boxing, the number of eyeballs that are on this thing? If it is a great spectacle and it's a great finish and it's thrilling start to finish, is there not the potential for it to be a launching point?
No.
Okay.
Thank you. That's great.
No, I would love to think it could be, but I just think it is a one-off. And like I was saying before, I'm not expecting a great fight. And I mean, if it were, you know, something along the lines of, you know, Gotti Ward, you know, yeah. Like if you had some sort of, you know, gothic action fight, maybe there would be something like that. But this is the antithesis of Arturo Gotti, Mickey Ward. This isn't that.
I'm just going to hope that this is the last raging against the dying of the light of a sport that's going to finally get off my radar and let us go about our business of paying attention to sports that actually pit, you know, people against people on the field of play without just beating the crap out of each other.
I like horse on horse sports.
If they let the horses fight, I would watch that.
You're a breeder?
Yeah.
I said fight.
Yeah. Okay.
Sports.
Let the horses fight.
I said sport.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. So it's a big day if you're into horse racing and boxing and I don't know.
Wait. Can I just say like that hunting, if we have darts, boxing, and we have the Kentucky Derby, and we're looking for ways to keep combat sports in the mainstream, can we bring back the joust? I would watch that. The Game of Thrones style jousting.
Yeah,
Lions versus Christians.
Can we put Floyd and Manny on horseback and give them lances?
You've seen that in medieval times, man.
I have seen that.
Anytime you want.
I know. I like it. Nobody really gets hurt.
There's a bunch of Blue Jays hurt right now, and a bunch of them with hurt feelings as well. They fall 9-4 to the Indians yesterday. 11-13 are the Blue Jays to start the year. We'll talk about a bunch of youngsters already being shipped down to AAA. The Blue Jays pitching a big-time mess. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Garrett Joyce and Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Garrett Joyce and Jordan Heath Rawlings. Blue Jays back in action today against the Cleveland Indians. Mike Wilner starting at 3 o'clock on Sportsnet 590, the Fan Network pregame at 3:30. Aaron Sanchez against Corey Kluber, coming off a 9-4 loss yesterday to the Indians and some roster moves of significance last couple of days. Daniel Norris sent down. That means Marco, don't call me Eric Estrada, into the rotation for at least one turnaround. And now Dalton Pompey has been demoted. So, gents, they start the season with six rookies, and that was the big news. And we all understood there would be growing pains I don't know if it's fair to say that it's all on the rookies. I think, Jordan, though, it's fair to say it's all on the pitching, both in the starting rotation and in the bullpen, the reason the Blue Jays are 11 and 13.
Oh, yeah. I mean, last check, I didn't check. What did they score last night? 4 runs? They were averaging 5.3 per game going into yesterday, which is among the best. I don't know exactly where it ranks, but it's top 10 for sure, probably top 5 in the big leagues. And if you had told me going into the season, after the Stroman injury, which is obviously a wrench in their plans, that they'd be averaging 5.3 runs a game and the rookies would have struggled completely with their control and Burley would have gotten off to a slow start. And so you're looking at a rotation where you're like, our best, most consistent pitcher so far has been R.A. Dickey. You know, you would have looked at that and been like, yeah, you're probably going to be in trouble.
Their ERA as a team is the highest in all of Major League Baseball. It's
30. Not shock me at all.
It's 30. And their starters ERA is 29. So I know it's the bullpen, and the bullpen was the question mark going into this season. But Gare, I mean, you spent a lot of time with Daniel Norris. You put the Gare Joyce curse on him, spending all that time with him. And now he's down in AAA.
I spent a lot of time with you too.
Oh, right? I think you just proved my point. So he's down in AAA, and we expect to see him again at some point, probably in the near future. Marcus Stroman went through this similar type of development, was sent down and then recalled and went on an absolute tear on his return. Do you see any fixes? I don't want to say quick fixes. I can't see a quick fix unless you get Cole Hamels. But, I mean, is there any reason for optimism when it comes to the pitching on this team?
I don't know. I don't think so. As currently constituted, no. You know, when I look at Norris and Pompey for that matter, you know, the old saying is like, for those that you wish to destroy, you first make famous, right? Like in the case of the Jays, it's sort of, you know, those who you would destroy, you name to the opening day roster, right? I imagine both these guys were going to be in Buffalo at the start of the season. And, you know, I mean, I thought in spring training before Stroman is hurt that ideally a fifth starter would emerge that would allow them to bring Norris up in June or something like that. I mean, I think we have to remember that, you know, at this point last year, he wasn't just an A ball. He was considered an underachieving A ball pitcher to that point. You know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that he was considered a miss rather than a hit. You know, a year ago, if anyone had told you Dalton Pompey is going to be in the majors, you know, you would have been laughed at probably by Dalton Pompey as well.
But here's the thing. Things change so quickly, as Daniel Norris over the last year has shown us, you know, and as, like you said, Ben Stroman did last year, where you just, especially with young pitchers, where you're just, you can't find the control. You can't quite find the release point. There's a little hitch in your delivery. Something happens under the bright lights that scares you a little bit. There's nothing to say, and I don't want to cast myself as the optimistic everything will be fine person, because I do think there's problems there. But if you told me that a month from now Daniel Norris would be back in the big leagues and throwing hard and well, I would not be shocked.
I thought all along, right, that, I mean, Norris had a fantastic year last year. I got to see part of it play out. But, you know, everyone talked about the van and the lifestyle this offseason.
Yeah, that wasn't good for him.
You know what? No one talked about the surgery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, this is a guy coming off arm surgery. I thought that was one of the reasons that he'd be in Buffalo, right? That
they would have him on a pitch count. Yeah, one guy's dealing with dead arm, and you need a place to let him work through it that's not a major league rotation that's going to get him hammered every time he comes out.
Well, and there are a few mitigating factors. He pitched in some pretty lousy weather a couple of times, and certainly in Cleveland it wasn't warm the other day. It's kind of curious that they would pull the rug out from under him so quickly, though. because like
he seemed to know it though.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, I guess
when he was.
I don't know, we haven't heard from him. We just saw the tweet.
But. Yeah.
Yeah, no, but even during the game, yeah. Like you could see him
looking over.
Yeah, and he went off. Like even when he got out of the one in the second inning, I guess it was.
Yeah.
The Sox were loaded. I mean, he came off and he looked like so distressed. Like you just sort of thought there has to be something more here.
Oh, he was shook. I mean, whether it was physical or whether it was just he knew he didn't have his control. I mean, it's you don't often see pitchers, especially young pitchers who have really quality stuff, just look so lost out there without even giving up a run. Like they took him out after three innings to limit the damage, even though there'd been no damage yet. You know what I mean?
That's the thing. He's got the lowest ERA among all the Blue Jays starters now.
And maybe the highest whip. I don't know.
He threw 70 pitches through two innings in that start.
And allowed seven base runners, I think, something like that.
Now, it's not as simple as saying the Blue Jays are screwing up the kids by bringing them up so early, because there are guys like Devin Travis who has never seen AAA and appears like he's never going to leave the major leagues now. I mean, it could all come unglued for him tomorrow, but I mean, all the indicators are there. He's going foul line to foul line, getting deep in counts.
Is this the Ben Ennis curse that you're presenting here?
Yeah, seriously.
So what? Did I just curse Devin Travis? Then?
Can we save that clip? Can we keep that in the library
somewhere? I added the caveat that it could all come unglued for him, but now he looks pretty good. Yeah.
Well, look, it's funny. You're going with six rookies in your opening day lineup, and you look at that, and you're like, well, you know, two of these will be sent down in a month.
Sure.
One of these will establish himself as a fairly regular contributor.
And one of them will be a star.
One of them will be a leader, front runner, absolutely, for rookie of the year right now.
So isn't that fair? Like, I mean, that's kind of
not a
even?
Terrible, yeah, not a terrible success rate. I mean, if you think... It's not usual for teams to go with this many rookies, and I think if you looked at that and said you're going to roll the dice and this is how they're going to come out, you probably would have taken it. You would have hoped, given the Jays' circumstances, that the rookie of the year guy would be a pitcher, but it didn't happen that way. And I don't know. I mean, Sanchez and Norris's stuff is not going anywhere.
Right.
They both still have – I mean, even when they're missing their pitches, you can see the movement and the velocity. Like, it's not gone. They just need to figure it out.
Well, and Sanchez's stuff might just be too good in that he can't keep it in the zone because there's so much movement.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, and tonight will be, or this afternoon will be an interesting test of the adjustments he's made, because he's looked so dominant at times, even in starts.
Yeah.
The seven walk game, his last time out, he was issuing a bunch of walks to the Red Sox before coming around late in that game. I mean, there's one thing to be a slugging team and slugging your way out of poor pitching performances or mediocre pitching performance. It's tough to slug your way out of a starter going only 2-3 innings. I mean, you can get by. Like, if the Blue Jays were getting 6-7 innings, giving up 4-5 runs, I mean, that seems like that would be, you know. That's
a win right now. That's a win the way they're playing.
It certainly would. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath-Rawlings, Garrett Joyce. So the Blue Jays back in action against the Indians. The starting rotation is one part of the problem. The other part is the bullpen. And we've already seen this team blow, I think, three, maybe four games that they've led going into the eighth inning. Now, I generally think that even still that Miguel Castro and Roberto Osuna are going to be just fine. And Castro got into the game yesterday, struck out a pair, allowed a hit. But they're just being overused, I feel like, right now. Gare, I mean, how do you evaluate this Blue Jays bullpen? Because it was such an area of concern after the way it performed last year, and there weren't a whole lot of changes, and Alex Anthopoulos was hoping against hope that some 20-year-olds would come in and save it.
It's funny. With Castro, I actually saw him throw his first pitch in the Jays organization outside the Dominican.
Yeah.
and that was August 13, right? Like, it wasn't that long ago, right? In the Gulf Coast League. And I mean, he's a prodigiously talented guy, and I think the same thing applies. Those who you would destroy, you name to the opening day line or roster.
The thing about Osuna is, and I'm going to take issue with your overuse comment, Osuna was a starter. He's thrown 11 and 12 innings in a month.
Right. There's a thing,
I don't
think
he's overused.
I think his appearances lead this team. Yeah, there's
okay.
One thing.
He's your best reliever. He should. His appearances should lead.
He's
the
20
team.
Months removed from Tommy John surgery, and there's a different thing, you know, pitching once every 5 days, throwing 80 to 100 pitches, and it's another working on back-to-back days and four out of five and whatever.
And how many times has he got up and not got in?
Right. I mean, you just have to look at the performances recently to realize that they've been overused. I mean, if you want, you can debate it if you want. I think
I just did.
But you can't imagine it was the master plan.
No.
You know, like in the offseason.
Yeah. Ideally, you have a couple. Yeah, no. Ideally,
no,
you have.
No, but these guys are your go-tos.
Well, I mean, what was the master plan then? Because
for those guys to be a part of a bullpen crew that would kind of get it done by committee and hand the ball to Cecil. But that's obviously not an option given the way it's panned out.
But if not them, who? I mean, was Aaron Loop supposed to? I mean, Aaron
Loop's
fine.
Supposed to be better than he's being.
Delabar was supposed to be here. Maybe.
A guy that was in AAA last year, really? Like, that's who you're relying on?
A guy who didn't even get the call this time when they needed some arms from AAA.
They're just, to my mind, was not much of a plan in the bullpen. And it was just a hope. It was a, let's see how much stuff we'll play in the major leagues. There was not a lot of offseason movement as far as bringing in projects, pet projects, guys on one-year deals that you know, might turn into something. It was, hey, this is what we got. Liam Hendricks is now a big part of this bullpen right now.
Well, it's funny, Ben, because we had this conversation in spring training, and we both had questions about the bullpen and whether or not it was going to work. And I think we both kind of agreed that in that situation, what you do is you do bring in like three or four guys on one-year contracts, and you give them some innings, and you let them throw, and you see if you can sort of mine a couple of gold nuggets. And they did not do that, and instead sort of relied on giving guys like Castro and Asuna a chance, which has, I think, for the most part, worked out okay, and I think will work out okay. But then you're left with the dregs after that, and they don't have anybody. That's the problem, is there's nobody competing to get in this rotation or get into the bullpen. Where on a healthy team, you have guys who are knocking on the door, and nobody's knocking on any door. Door's wide open.
Yeah, I've never, as a fan, you know, I love buying those lottery tickets. You know, those sure. You're talking about those signing those journeyman guys to 1 year contracts.
Sure, Jeff Francis.
You know, minor league contracts and praying for rain. You know, I mean, and sometimes it works out. And every time it works out, you think, God, I wish my team had gone out and done that. But like it plays out that way so infrequently. It's just not a good play.
No, but when your options are limited, you might as well.
Well, it's a different type of lottery ticket when you're talking about 20-year-olds. And Castro pitched in his 12th game yesterday. The Blue Jays have played 24. He's on pace for 80-plus appearances this season.
Osuna that might be only a little bit much.
Yeah, I think. Would lead the major leagues of baseball if he did that.
You just look at Castro's build, too, right? It's not like he's made for the long haul. It
no
like.
Meat on him.
Osuna not far behind with 10 appearances, and at least it seems though that Castro has a pretty good mental makeup, and he was able to bounce back after a couple of rough outings. Mentioned Devin Travis as one of the positives on this team, and this team can hit, right? Like, is there any doubt that this team is going to hit? And in some respect, if you were going to take the positive view of the first 24 games and their 11-13 record, you would say, can the pitching get much worse? Can the injury situation be much worse? In Jose Bautista still not being able to play right field. Devin Travis seems every other day he's taking a ball either off the collarbone or in the ribs.
If there's one thing I've learned about this team, never ask if the injury situation can get worse.
Well, and that being said, they're 11-13. So is there nothing positive to say about that, or is it?
Oh, I think it's been a fairly mediocre start, but there's certainly like light shining through. I mean, Josh Donaldson has been fantastic. Batista's been playing hurt, but still coming up with some key hits, if not the volume of hits you're used to. Edwin hasn't really got it going yet, but like there's bats all over the lineup. Kevin Pillar has been a fantastic surprise.
You know what? If there's light shining through, it's not bright enough that you have to wear welding glasses or anything
that.
No, it's just a
sliver. Definitely not.
Yeah.
It's like that, like you're in solitary and it's that little sliver of light.
Hey, it's a month
through.
Of baseball out of six and you're close to 500. And certainly it doesn't look like the AL East is blowing anybody away this year. And like you said, the pitching can't get much worse. So you are where you are, you know.
Mark Burley tosses 4 1/3 innings yesterday, giving up 8 earned runs on 11 hits. His ERA now approaching 7. Is there anything to be made out of that? I mean, we all got so worked up after the start that he had last year and was the Blue Jays' best pitcher by miles to start the season. Nobody could touch him. The number of strikeouts he was registering. But it's been a rough go, to say the least, the last couple of times out. 24 hits over his last two starts. He's a guy that will put it in play, Gare. I guess this is what you get with Mark Burley. You get the bad with the good.
I think he should try working more slowly.
Yeah, that's it. You know, do something.
Just think about it a little bit. Yeah.
You know what? Mark Burley, I think, you know, it's just like the weather, right? Like it's always going to be there. It's going to balance out. You know, I think the real guy was what he was in the second half rather than the first half last year. And what we're getting, I think, is really more the same of what he was in the second half. He's going to eat innings. He's going to get up and balls will be put in play. And when balls are put in play, things happen. Some of them good, some of them bad, you know? And I mean, but you need him as an inning eating guy, right? I don't know, even when he was running out to the big start last year, you know, would you say Mark Burley, number one starter on a division winning team?
No,
never.
Nope. He's getting a little BABIP to death, but I think eventually the luck will swing around and the end of the season we'll be looking at a pretty prototypical Mark Burley season. Blue Jays continuing that series in Cleveland. Pregame show starting at 3:30 on Sportsnet 1 and 3 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. That'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. I've got Sportsnet Today coming up at noon, taking you through until 3 o'clock. For Gare Joyce, Jordan Heath-Rawlings, I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.